Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anthony Bourdain hit it big 10 years ago with his best-selling memoir, Kitchen Confidential. The sharp-eyed chef took us behind the scenes with, as he put it, the whacked-out moral degenerates, dope fiends, refugees, drunks, sneak thieves, sluts, and psychopaths that he had come to know behind the kitchen doors of some of America's best-known restaurants. Then Bourdain went global with his No Reservations hit TV show, eating and engaging all over the world. Now he's back to tell us what he's learned, and his knife and eye are still sharp. This hour on Point, Anthony Bourdain on life, life in the kitchen, and what he's thinking now. You can join the conversation. Are you a Bourdain fan? What's the special sauce he brings to the table? Has the master of the kitchen tell-all become a global truth-teller? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is best-selling author, chef, and television host Anthony Bourdain. He's author of Kitchen Confidential and many more volumes since, and host of the Travel Channel show, Anthony Bourdain, No Reservations. His new book is Medium Raw, a bloody Valentine to the world of food and the people who cook. Anthony Bourdain, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
You were gone for kind of 10 years. This is sort of like your Kitchen Confidential sequel. I mean, gone in the sense of being not exactly in that biz and out on the road, and now you're looking back in the kitchen. Is it the same, sea of perversion and wildness that you described 10 years ago, or has it changed?
Well, it's fair to say that the same personality types that have always been attracted to the restaurant business continue to be attracted. One of the reasons I wrote the book was because the business has changed so much in 10 years. It has inarguably become a much more professional environment in the kitchen. A lot of the behavior I was writing about in the 70s, 80s, and 90s right. that I covered in Kitchen Confidential would probably not be acceptable in quality kitchens these days. And I guess most significantly, the prestige level of the chef has really changed, and that's led to really a new world for diners and definitely a better life for cooks.
So they're not snorting cocaine through the penne pasta anymore and sort of
not during the shift,
on the cutting
at least,
board?
that would be frowned upon.
That was then, this is now. And what about you? How have you changed in that decade out on the road?
Well, when I wrote Kitchen Confidential, as I think is clear from the tone of the book, I mean, I had a very narrow world view. I was standing in a busy kitchen working 14, 16 hours a day. With no hope or expectation that I would ever leave the kitchen. It had been 28 years. I thought that's the way it would always be. Almost overnight after Kitchen Confidential, I found myself in the ridiculously luxurious position where I could travel anywhere I wanted in the world and eat and drink to excess and make television about it. So in a sense, that's made me it certainly changed me. It's changed my perspective, and the book reflects that as well.
I'm trying to figure out that perspective. It's a lot of fun. I have to say, it's a terrific book. I enjoyed it a lot. You're still pretty tough on people. You can get that sharp knife out in a big hurry. And very funny, you say back when Kitchen Confidential was on the table, you would have given Oprah a bikini wax to get on her show with a book. I mean, and that's just, you know, it flies fast and furious. Are you are you still as tough? You say you don't want to be buried in a black leather jacket. Are you lightening up a little bit? Are you still the tough guy? How do you see it?
I mean, I've been traveling. First of all, I've been living a ridiculously good life for the last 10 years. Yeah. And that alone, not going home exhausted and broke and collapsing into bed every night, that changes a person. Seeing how other people live around the world, living your dreams, but at the same time seeing how hard it is for people in other countries, having been frequently the recipient of random acts of kindness from strangers, that changes one's view, seeing how the similarities and differences of people around the world from very different backgrounds. And then, of course, I'm a father of a 3-year-old little girl now, and
congratulations.
That, more than anything, changes a person.
We want to hear about all of that. We don't want to lose sight of your connection to the cuisine. There's a great scene right at the top of the book, Medium Raw, where you've got what you describe as kind of a meeting of the high mafia dons of the haute cuisine world
called together very surreptitiously late at night in a fancy restaurant in New York. Describe what you were doing there.
Well, none of us knew what to expect. We knew we were all summoned by friends. We knew that the restaurant we were going to was a very serious, very famous one with a famous chef. When you get an invitation like that, especially a mysterious one accompanied by "don't tell anyone," you show. And I didn't know who else was going other than the person who invited me. I walk in and there are some of the most famous chefs in the world all standing around looking with expectant grins on their faces at the bar. And it was quite, I'm still a fanboy of a lot of these people. So I was thrilled and delighted. And what ended up being for dinner was one of the rarest most morally questionable but delicious meals on earth.
That sounds like Bourdain territory, delicious and morally questionable. I had never heard of this. I didn't even know how to pronounce it.
It's called ortolan. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful piece written years ago that was, I think, in the back of a lot of our minds as we sat down, those of us who'd never had it, about Mitterrand, President Mitterrand's last meal.
France, yeah.
He'd asked for this. It's a very ritualistic experience. It's eaten for hundreds of years. The tradition is to eat it with a hood over your head.
It's a little bird. It's like you say, finch-like, rare at this point, bird from French cuisine.
Endangered, not terribly rare. I think it's the fact that it's a songbird makes it a protected species, but certainly not something I'd encourage people to eat in great numbers. Yes, and you eat it whole, bones, guts, everything in.
Napkin over the head, and how is it cooked, and how does it go down?
It's roasted in a little metal, a tiny little metal pan, or sort of like a muffin tin.
It's not gutted. It's everything's in there, and it goes in head first or feet first.
Goes in feet first with the head hanging out of your mouth, and it's sizzling, screamingly hot, and you have to sort of breathe circularly as you're bouncing it around in your mouth so you don't scald yourself. And then when you're ready, you crunch your teeth down through the body, and the guts and the Armagnac go rushing down your throat, and it's a real the bones prick your gums, and it's a very sort of a mind-body pain-pleasure experience.
And here's a dozen top chefs in the middle of the night with napkins over their heads, and it sounds kind of like a satanic ritual.
Yeah, cool, huh?
I guess.
It was really one of the great, great moments of my life.
So there's the real chefs, the ones that you admire. You say you're still a fanboy, but in the 10 years you've been away, and in a funny way, you may have helped kick this off, though it was already gearing up. But, I mean, the world of food has become such a mega media location. What's the effect of that, of all this super media attention, reality shows and contests and competitions and you name it? Is it making food better? Is it making us better eaters or the opposite?
It seems to be. I mean, I don't know that people who are watching Food Network are actually cooking what they see. But what it definitely has done, even at its most ridiculous and clown-like, this phenomena has without a doubt raised the level of interest in chefs, raised their prestige, their self-image, and empowered them in significant ways to alter their menus, to serve in their restaurants food that they themselves like to eat, rather than adhering to the old way, which was to a conventional menu designed to please the largest number of people, the common denominator.
You're being so awfully nice. You've trashed a lot of these food
media. Well, listen,
people.
My head may want to explode in flame every time I see Sandra Lee on TV, and I'm certainly not a fan of Rachel Ray's cooking, but I grudgingly admit that they're part of the phenomena that has raised interest in the status of people who cook, and that has to be a good thing. We're certainly eating better in America today in most restaurants and even medium range restaurants than when I started out. And the life of the chef is more hopeful and better, and they hold a more elevated status in society than they did when I started out. So. You know, that's all good. Who better deserves a nice score, us or Kardashians?
Right. Let's get our callers. They're lining up. Nashville, Shannon, you're on the air with Anthony Bourdain.
Hi, Chef Bourdain. It's a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks. I worked as a private yacht chef for 13 years, went to culinary school then, and then continued for another 12 long, painful, but incredibly wonderful years traveled the world, as I now sit on the couch and watch you travel the world. And one of the greatest things I got from your Kitchen Confidential book coming out was all of a sudden I had a lot more owners in my galley staring at what I did to their food.
They wanted to know.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean,
private yacht really chef, that sounds like debauchery territory 101.
You know, in the old days, no one cared what the chef thought, mm-hmm. and the idea of people wanting to see what the chefs are doing in the kitchen was unthinkable. We were the backstairs help. So that's definitely changed. And I want to thank the caller because, yeah, it's a hard life, but it's a great one. And it's like running away with the circus, and you look back at it, you think, I wouldn't have changed anything.
And now you're the one who's out on the hoof, and she's watching you on the tube. Do you have many chefs who are following your travels and saying, oh, I wish, what a lucky guy, I should be out there?
Well, you know, the really satisfying part is when chefs who already have TV shows, you know, privately tell me, man, how come I can't do what you do?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with author, chef, and global, provocateur, Anthony Bourdain, about his life, life on the road, life in kitchens, what he's thinking now. He's out 10 years after Kitchen Confidential with a kind of sequel, Medium Raw. He's called it a bloody Valentine to the world of food and the people who cook. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Anthony Bourdain joins us from New York. Let's listen to just a little bit from No Reservations. Here's his team arriving in the dead of winter in the far north of China, Harbin. He's got a less than exceptional time eating the traditional fare in this passage.
What's that?
It's kind of pork jelly. You put that in the soy sauce with the garlic in there. It gives it a strong flavor.
Maybe it's the cold outside or the benzene and mercury vapor from the coal smoke, but I'm having real trouble enjoying this. And I like pork, as you may have noticed.
Like it?
It's good.
I'm unhappy. I freeze up like Nicole Kidman's forehead, and Tom Vitale, my producer,
don't film me,
sensing that the scene is going off the rails, deploys our fixer Matt into the scene in the hope that things will get more lively.
These woodier mushrooms, they're better here than anywhere else in the country.
Actually, I've been to those farms on the way to Russia.
Nope.
Anthony Bourdain in No Reservations. Anthony Bourdain, we've got a lot of callers for you. Lori, Acton, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Hi.
I love your writing and your shows, but I have a practical question for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You seem to have an iron stomach, and I seem to get an upset stomach like eating in the next county over. So I was wondering if you have a secret traveler's remedy you can share with us, or do you get sick too and they just don't broadcast it?
No, honestly, I eat what the locals eat, and that seems to be a good practice. If they're not drinking the water or they're not eating something, I don't eat it. I don't eat international hotel food if I can avoid it. I think a constant exposure to food around the world, you toughen up, you build up resistance. You can't be too careful and too clean. I have been sick a couple of times in the last 9 years, but to tell you the truth, and it's true of most of us on the crew, if we eat locally, we generally do well.
Too careful, too clean, that definitely does not describe your approach on the road. I mean, you're a big street food advocate.
Yeah, and I think that's the way to go. The people who get sick on our crew are the ones who are a little over. You know, they're wiping themselves down with sanitizer every time they go to the bathroom. They're always getting sick, like on a club sandwich at the hotel. It's not the local food that brings them down.
Let's listen to a little more. You weren't so crazy about the pork jelly in Harbin, but here you are in Vietnam, one of your favorite places, I guess, in the Central Highlands, and talking to a couple who specialize in beef noodle soup.
Bun Bo Huy, spicy, delicious, vibrant, and soulful.
Ah, the smell is great, huh?
Yeah.
It's become something of a national dish here. It represents everything I love about Vietnamese cuisine.
Yeah, how long does it take to make the broth? Because the broth is magical. The soup itself?
All together is about 1 hour.
Beef, pork, blood cake, noodles, and broth. Fresh greens are added to the already fragrant and brightly colored soup, which melts into a sort of deliciously psychedelic mix.
A little blood cake, a few fresh greens, and we're very happy. Ben in Orlando, Florida, you're on the air with Anthony Bourdain.
Hey, how's it going, Anthony?
Well, good. How are you?
I hope you don't mind me calling you Anthony.
Whatever you like, man.
I hear you. I've been watching your show for a few years now. Back in 2003, I came down with melanoma cancer and was stuck in the house for about 6 months, couldn't work, and fell in love with Food Network, and then fell in love with your show. Really watch your, love watching your travels and all. I saw where you went to the Far East, I think it was Saudi Arabia, and I was wondering why you were over there. Did you ever fear for anything, bodily danger, or I didn't see a whole lot of guns or anything around. Was it a pretty serene trip?
Absolutely. I think one of the joys of the show is that we've found that if your priority is just to eat and to highlight what people put on their table and their hospitality in their homes, there's just about no place on earth that you cannot go. People, once you sit down at the table with them and you make it clear your agenda is not to argue about politics or religion, but just, you know, what do you like? What do you serve at home? What gives you pleasure? What are you proud of? It's easy to make friends all over the world, and you're more likely to find what you've got in common with them than what's different. So, no, that was at no time. At no time was a security a factor in Saudi Arabia.
You know, our caller in Orlando's following you and others there, but you around the world, I have to say, I really was not plugged into the show, didn't know about it, and got a big heads up on it from a super fan who happened to be one of my own kids. You're a father now, so you know how you start to listen. Your daughter's three now?
Yeah.
Before you know it, she'll be older. One of my sons, Ben, said, "This is just an amazing, amazing show. You've got to watch it." He's 24 years old and got me into it. Hope you don't mind. I invited him in today because I wanted him to
great.
Meet you and ask him. Hi, Ben.
So great to be here.
He's based in L.A. working on his own sort of putting together a cable show on green cities. But Ben, you're 24 years old. Anthony Bourdain is not. What do you love about his show?
I guess I'm restating here, but Mr. Bourdain, a huge fan. Great, real pleasure to chat with you here.
Thank you.
You know, there's so many things I love about it, but when it boils down to it, and, you know, I also think this is the reason that so many people my age have become so fascinated with your writing and your show, is that everything you deal with, all your interactions are so authentic. They're so real. It's that no BS approach that you take. You know, there's so much stuff on TV right now that lacks that. You know, I see topics and conversations that are interesting, but without that real factor, without that, you know, say whatever's on your mind, raw, thing going on, a conversation and a dialogue can only be so compelling. And I think you've mastered that in a way that has won over many, many people.
Hey, there you go.
Well, thank you. It's an incredible luxury that I'm very grateful for because I guess I made it with a really obnoxious book that was extraordinarily candid and profane.
Right.
And I think when people... anyone who's done business with me since or who's been silly enough to give me a television show or let me write a book, nobody's expecting me to suddenly morph into, a diplomat. So I really have the benefit, the privilege, it's a very unique one, of being able to speak my mind. And that's something that most people just are simply not allowed to do. I don't know any other way, so that helps.
That seems evident. When Josh Ozersky calls you the most honest man in American media, what do you make of that? I mean, I'm a news guy, so I'm looking with a little jealousy what's the news media supposed to think about that when Tony Bourdain is the most honest guy?
I have to say I'm really, really grateful for that quote because, you know, I happen to know that Josh is friends with some of the people who I absolutely savage in the book. So that,
yes,
that probably saying that came at a personal cost for him, and I'm really grateful.
I'm curious, Ben, you've watched, I know I've watched some, you've watched a ton. Mm-hmm. What episodes come back to mind of No Reservations? What moments?
You know, it's the ones, you know, back to this real thing. You know, I'm sure you'll remember this, the one in Jamaica when you guys were your whole production staff was going down into some cave. And it was just so blatantly clear that you did not want to be there, and you were pissed.
It was just so real.
It was so real.
It was.
What's wrong with being in a cave? Were you eating bat guano down there?
He was falling over.
It was unspeakably hot, and it was slicked with, you know, inch-thick bat guano all the way down, and we were not having a good time. I mean, it was just hellish.
But, you know, other shows might just cut that, you know? But you guys went with it, and that, your just genuine response and wearing all your emotions right on your sleeve right there was just so endearing.
But here's the thing. That's the opposite of most of the smiling kind of, you know, you write about Emeril and others, Rachel Ray, you name it. It's all like big plastered on grin in the food media network world in general.
Yeah, where everything's, you know, everything's beautiful and nothing hurts. Yeah. And yet, you know, you see a lot of these people say, this is great. Clearly, it's not. You know, clearly, it's inedible. So why are you smiling and telling me it's good? You know, it undercuts their authenticity. Let's put it that way.
Let's get Stephanie in Tuptiva, Florida. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hello. I am so thrilled I got through. Anthony, I love you. I watch you every time. I mean, I don't know about schedules, but I am watching you every time I can. You're fantastic.
Thanks. Thank you.
Now, I have to ask you, since you drink all these crazy brews, what do you do for the what appears to be a situation of a hangover?
Well, I mean, you...
Good question, Stephanie. There's a lot of knocking back the local brew that goes on, yeah.
It these days, there's really almost nothing to be done. You know, back in the day, for me, the best hangover cure and a don't try this at home kind of a thing, but I found that a Coca-Cola, a cold Coke, followed by a joint, followed by some spicy, like, leftover Kung Pao chicken was very effective. These days, I'm a father of a 3-year-old, so I really can't do the middle thing anymore. I kind of need my brain at all times.
Yeah.
So there's really not much that helps. I just sort
you
of
suffer.
Tough it out.
And,
yeah, I suffer.
And what about your old drug habits? Behind you? Far behind you? Still
yeah,
tempting?
Yeah, it's been a long time. No. I mean, when I put down, white powders, when I put those down, I was done. I'd love to say it's been a heroic day, you know, everyday struggle since, but frankly, no. I mean, I make all the best decisions of my life I make when there's no other decision to be made, and that's that.
Ben, take us to another episode you recall of Anthony Bourdain's.
Wow, that's so many. The one that was Emmy nominated was the one that was in Beirut. It was filmed in 2006, and Bourdain and his whole staff got stuck there when the Israel-Lebanon conflict opened up.
Yeah.
And my gosh, that was just such great television.
Thanks.
I know. I'm sure you remember.
Not a happy time, but yeah. You know, I'm very happy to say that just a few weeks ago we got back from successfully filming a very happy episode in Beirut, something that ever since I left on the LCU with the Marine Expeditionary Unit in 2006,
wow.
Yeah.
Ever since that, it's been the great unfinished business of my life. I've been desperate and miserable that I wasn't able to show people how amazing and hopeful and how promising Beirut is, and how I think most Americans, most anybody with a heart and a love for food and people and culture would find it. So until I was able to do that, my life was just in no way ever going to be complete. And I'm really happy we finished what's going to be a really cool episode there.
But isn't that an example of a kind of scene that can't be patched up with a good, you know, bouillabaisse? I mean, it's just...
Well, I mean, we were, you know, we look out the window and, you know, Hezbollah drove right through our scene firing into the air, and then we went home and saw the airport blowing up, which we were supposed to get out on. When we were trapped there for almost 10 days, so there was no possibility of we were under, like, you know, house arrest by our security guys for much of that, so there was no possibility of doing anything but shooting ourselves and what was going on around us.
Let's get a call from Bill in Boston. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mr. Bourdain, love the show.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the fact that you show different cultures and how they prepare their food and the different types of food that they make. It really, like, broadens my horizons when I'm in the, you know, different farmers markets or different supermarkets to try something different. My question to you is actually a little bit of it looking for a little bit of advice. 27 years old, I've been in a career for 10 years, and over the past 4 or 5 years, I have a huge passion for cooking, mostly just for family and friends. And as the years go by, I consider getting into as a career myself. What would be your advice to break into the industry? Would it be culinary school or just jumping right into the kitchen and working my way up?
You're right on the age limit right around now. 27, 28, beyond that, it's going to be very, very, very tough for you by the time you're trained up and ready to really work and make money in the industry. It's going to be late. I mean, you're going to be you're practically Methuselah at 27. What I would definitely recommend before you quit your previous profession is work for free if necessary, or just get a few months, 6 months in a very busy restaurant, any busy restaurant, get your butt kicked. See if you really like it before you spend money on culinary school, because no matter how good the culinary school, you're going to be rolling out of there, and the best you can hope for is like, like a $10 an hour job for the first couple of years. You're not going to be paying back that student loan anytime soon. So just make sure you love the business, that it's for you, that it's a passion, and that you're willing to suffer for it and do without any kind of reasonable amount of money for quite some time.
And let's say age was no issue here. What do you say to young people thinking about getting in? These media shows, yours right. included, I suppose, have made it very appealing to think about getting into the kitchen as a professional chef. What do you say
to them? It's like rock and roll, in the sense that, most people who, you better just love playing rock and roll for playing rock and roll. If you think you're going to be a star, that, as most any musician will tell you, that's an unreasonable expectation. Do it because you love it. And most importantly, get out there and do it first. Find out if that life is for you. Chances are it's not. You'll know it after a few months in the business. And then culinary school is a very worthwhile enterprise.
Well, you certainly made my guy really interested in the global part of it. We just got him for another minute here with me in the studio. Ben, here's your shot. Anthony Bourdain, what's your question?
Ooh, well, I guess I'd come at you with this. Was there a certain job you had, or a certain moment, an interaction with someone, where you realized that faking smiles and forcing interactions is just not worth it? When did you realize that?
I think very, very, very early on. I think all of the important things I learned about my life, all my life lessons I learned as a dishwasher. I'm looking at the world and behaving, all of my behaviors were formed by that kitchen ethic. I didn't have to smile at anybody I didn't like in the kitchen, so I didn't. And by the time I hit it on TV, I didn't have to, and I couldn't have. So it's not a decision I made. I sensed in myself very, very early on that I was not the sort of person who could work an office job or certainly a sales job. In fact, I shouldn't be interacting with normal people in a normal way. And I think a lot of chefs find themselves in the business because they sense that that dysfunction in themselves. And, I'm just lucky enough that I'm making a living off of being dysfunctional.
It's funny to me. I don't find myself as a person who would really enjoy interacting with a cynical person. Yet on your show, there's a lot of cynicism there. But what I've learned from your writing and your shows is that when you're that honest, cynicism just kind of comes with the territory. But yours is an honest cynicism, which is a breath of fresh air in a way.
Anthony Bourdain, makes sense to you?
That sounds good to me.
My son, Ben, 24, got me on to you. Ben, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. Great
thanks,
to be
Ben.
Here.
Anthony
so
Bourdain,
cool.
Please stand by in New York. The new book is Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with chef and global provocateur Anthony Bourdain about his life on and off the road in kitchens, what he's thinking these days. His new book is Medium Raw. Kitchen Confidential came out 10 years ago. This is, in a way, a sequel, looking out on the whole world of professional food and chefs. You may have watched him on the air. What do you think? Has he mellowed? Is he medium raw these days, or still just raw? Line cooks, chefs, professional kitchen folk. What does Anthony Bourdain stand for to you? Does he tell it like it is? Anthony Bourdain, lots of comments here. Some from Facebook. Let's see. Julianne loves the show, wants to know how you keep it fresh and interesting. Loved your show in Milwaukee. Now she wants to do one. Here's Lori, and she says, I'm a vegetarian who loves Anthony Bourdain. Go figure. Actually, when he takes snarky cracks at us, and you do plenty, I laugh as hard as anyone. What is it about you and vegetarians? What's up there?
I guess I've been so fortunate to see the world, and it's such a rare and wonderful experience to travel the world. It just seems rude to me. I understand personal principle and personal choices about what you eat in your home.
Rude, but it's supposed to be like, global kindness, don't eat animals. That doesn't sound rude.
Meaning people take their food, their cuisines, what they have very seriously. Often they have less than us. So when you find yourself at someone's home where they're offering you animal protein, it's what I call the grandma rule. I mean, I may not like grandma's food, but I'm going to smile, thank her for it, and ask for seconds. So I think in that sense, just to bond with other people, the human dimension is far more important than your personal principles. And I also feel that, you know, given the opportunity to try everything in the world, you should at least experience as much of it as you can if you're lucky enough to travel. To be a vegetarian to me when traveling is like saying I'm going to the Louvre but only planning on looking at paintings in the color blue and red.
And a diss in a way that you won't go with the local cuisine. Here's another one from Jonathan. Says, I'm a big fan of No Reservations. Just finished Kitchen Confidential, 10 years on, I guess. But he says, one thing he's never quite understood about Anthony is the disconnect between his adoration of meat, in all of its glory, he writes, and his, that is, your general lack of respect for the animal itself. Take the pig, he's writing, which is the animal whose meat Tony reveres, and so does Caesar. But, you know, why don't you care more about the pig itself, not just the pork?
I do care about the pig. I mean, ultimately, we're going to kill him and eat him. I would prefer it if he had as happy and healthy a life as possible. It is without question that even if you don't have a heart, and I think I do, that animals that are stressed, unhappy, and miserable do not taste good. They lead to bad food. So I'm against battery chickens. I don't like the way we raise food proteins for animals for meat in this country. But at the same time, I'm not. I think we should look the. We should know where our meat comes from. You know, we see animals killed on the show, as I think people who eat meat should. We are culpable. We are guilty. Mm. But once you've made that decision, I'm not going to pretend. I don't know if it's disrespectful to show an animal dying. I would prefer to think you're at least acknowledging their part in the cycle of life. I think our obligation is to honor the ingredient, meaning you treat them well as they live, and you don't waste them and cook them as respectfully as possible when they're dead.
You do write in Medium Raw that maybe we eat too much meat, that our sort of American, you know, got to have it every meal approach has its downside.
There's no question. We're eating five times as much chicken and animal protein as we did a few decades ago, clearly. And the things that we are doing in order to keep up with our ravenous need for cheap, underline the word cheap, meat and poultry are clearly destructive. So as carnivorous as I am, and as much as I love meat and pork and chicken, I think that we clearly and inarguably have a distorted relationship as far as how much of the stuff we're going to be eating and how low a quality we're willing to accept.
Here's a Rotten Tomato online comment. Mr. Bourdain, you're a poser. Rachel Ray cooks. You don't. Why do you bother traveling around the world to eat, but all you do once you're there is complain about the local weather, people, food, etc.? Sunil.
I think if you've seen anything more than one of my shows, it's clear I'm having the time of my life. I'm hardly in the business of complaining or mocking people. That's not what the show's about at all. I can't believe for a second, Sir Rome Adam, that you've watched the show. In fact, I cooked for 28 years professionally. I put in my time.
Rachel Ray's got you trumped on the cooking front?
I'm not even going to address that. I'm not even beating up on Rachel anymore. She's low-hanging fruit.
David in Toronto, in Ontario, Canada. David, you're on the air with Anthony Bourdain.
Hey, Anthony, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
Good. It's a real, real pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, sir.
I'm a huge fan, and I, too, cooked professionally for 28 years, starting in probably about 1980. And I have to say that I spent the last 10 years since Kitchen Confidential came out trying to keep my parents from getting a copy of it.
So they wouldn't be on to you?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I just, I took up working in kitchens as a dishwasher to fund a guitar so I could mm-hmm. play in a band that we were sure was going to be bigger than and as good as the Dead Boys. And I ended up getting more sex, drugs, and rock and roll in kitchens than I ever did playing guitar.
Anthony Bourdain says it's cleaned up in the years since. What do you think?
I just recently left, and I'll have to say I noticed a big difference.
Yeah. The open kitchen really changed a lot of behavior, you know?
Absolutely.
Nowhere to hide.
Now my 15-year-old son's wanting to go into the biz, and I have to say I'm not scared to have him go.
Wow. There you go. David, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Enjoy that.
You've got your heroes in here. You've got your villains. You've got some kind of in between. You write interestingly on Alice Waters, the famous Alice Waters out of California, Chez Panisse. You, of course, famously once called her what, like Pol Pot of the kitchen? What's your view of the great Ms. Waters today?
Maybe I'm overstating the case a little bit there. Listen, I'm always having an argument in my head with Alice Waters. I agree with just about everything she says in principle. I just think she's a bad messenger for the cause.
Why?
I think she has a basic disconnect. She's a little too dogmatic. Anyone who tells you repeatedly that we'll all be happier on the farm, that we should all be, you know, the words purity and cleanliness come up too often. That's frightening to me, frankly. There's a disconnect between her comfortable life in Berkeley and the lives of most working people. I think she can't help but putting her foot in her mouth a lot when she's advocating, you know, a local sustainable lifestyle. She just keeps saying the wrong things, I mean, there's some really hilarious examples of this. But on the other hand, I mean. She did create the cradle of the revolution for American gastronomy of the last 30, 40 years. I'd like to see the world look a lot like she wants to see it. I just think the certainty with which she makes her argument is repellent to many and frightening to me.
You've got a whole chapter, Heroes and Villains. Give us a couple of each and why.
Well, Fergus Henderson is a hero to me because he's a chef in England who opened a restaurant serving largely offal, hooves and snouts and traditional English cooking.
Nose to Tail, his famous book, Nose to Tail Eating, I guess.
Yeah. And one of the most influential chefs in the world among people who may never have heard of him. Just the ripple effect of his good works has been far-reaching.
Mm-hmm. There's a hero. What about a villain?
I'm a bit disappointed with Wolfgang Puck, though I admire him enormously. He knuckled under to the anti-foie gras people at a time when a lot of his fellow chefs really needed his support, and I was unhappy about that, to say the least. Mm. Jonathan Gold, the food writer from the LA Weekly, is certainly a hero to me, highlighting local ethnic cheap eats and making it important. He won the Pulitzer for mm-hmm. his writing, as well he should have.
And you go after Brooke Johnson, head honcho at the Food Network. Villain. Why?
Yeah. A villain for being absolutely right about everything. No matter how dumb every dumb show she puts on, every horrible sounding venture she's green-lighted, it ends up being spectacularly successful and, you know, making every complaint I might have about it sound, you know, antique and silly because it's a huge success.
So you may not like her shows, but she's got the numbers.
She's got the numbers. There's no question about it. I mean, even the magazines, the Food Network branded magazines, are successful. And this at a time when newspapers and prestigious glossies across the nation are going under.
You say what you felt from her was indifference bordering on naked hostility. Okay.
we're not going to be going on a weekend together anytime soon.
Bowling Green, Kentucky. Angela, you're on the air with Anthony Bourdain.
Hi, Anthony. Hi. I just like to say I appreciate your entire style of your suave, and you represent or epitomize the New York state of mind.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
You tell it like it is, and I especially appreciate the way that you can also appreciate the down-home cook. I mean, when you were with your wife's relatives, you gave such high praise, and these are people who they weren't in a professional kitchen anywhere, but they gave you the best time, and you showed your appreciation for that. And I appreciate that, Anthony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think a lot of my favorite experiences on the show, and something we try to highlight as much as possible, are non-professional cooks. In fact, a successful show for us is one, and then there are no professional cooks at all. It's just we're eating in people's homes, their farms, maybe, you know, little food stalls. You know, that's the stuff that makes me happy.
Take us to another one or two of those. You've got almost 10 years of no reservations under your belt. What stands out, that the dish, the place?
Well, any time I'm in Vietnam, you'll notice on the show I'm happy. It's such a street food culture. People are so fiercely proud. You almost have to have an excuse ready ahead of time because strangers want to feed you. They see an American and they want to take you by the hand to their house or their favorite place, often bankrupting themselves in the process for the week. I mean, people in a lot of the world, people are so proud of their food, and they feel it brings honor to them and their family or their clan or their house or themselves to be good hosts. And, you know, often at great personal cost. And that's something that's life-changing to experience that.
You've done no reservations through a decade in which the United States first had a lot of sympathy after 9/11 and then, you know, took a lot of heat after the Iraq War got started.
Yep.
What about it, being an American out on the road, kind of, you know, with your camera crew and pushing into little restaurants and corners? Right. Hey, here's an American. What's the first reaction? Have you seen any change? What do you see?
I will just tell you bluntly that it's much, much, much easier since this last election to travel. We don't get the pitying looks anymore. That was really tough to get pitying looks from, you know, Germans, English, French, mostly our allies. You know,
were
the ones who were who were making it. You know, they were condescending. They were angry. They were pitying. The only places for, you know, 8 years that we got unvarnished and unrestrained USA number one pro-Americanism during the Bush years was, I tell you this without, I'm not joking, the northern part of Vietnam and mainland China.
Wow, okay.
USA number one,
the
Bush
new
number one, LeBron James number one.
Wow,
that's
okay.
What people would yell out to us.
Wow, that's great. Charlotte, North Carolina. David, you're on the air with Anthony Bourdain.
Hey, I had a question.
Sure.
Anthony always talks about, or all the people on the show today have been talking about Anthony being a real straight shooter, so I'm going to try to call a little BS here.
Call it.
You always, on your show, talk about these chefs like they're your old friends, and that they're, you act kind of like you've known these people forever, and I have a hard time believing that you always have. And so I
cannot have, right? Just showed up. Right.
Yeah.
And I want to know about how you find the amazing chefs and also the little down home local restaurants.
Right.
Sure. I've done quite a bit of traveling and not all of them are awesome.
Right.
And the showmanship piece, maybe.
Right.
Thanks, David. Anthony?
Well, we may go to a lot of attention. A lot of the chefs I have known for or have met before on book tour over the last 10 years since Kitchen Confidential. I didn't know anyone before 2000, that's for sure. But I very quickly did a lot of traveling and did run across a number of chefs around the world or was able to reach out to people through mutual friends, the chef mafia being having a pretty good reach. But we do reach out very early on in pre-production on the show, reaching out largely through local food bloggers, food writers, or friend-of-friend chefs who we reach out to and send them DVDs of the show. We explain what it is we're looking for, what kind of situations, and we work with them in advance, a representative on the ground who lives in that place, to develop a number of suggestions or research possibilities that we've expressed interest in. So if I probably am guilty at times of saying my friend, you know, Chef Juan over here, you know, yes, the possibility exists. In fact, the likelihood that we just met a few days earlier.
But it's a good gig. You've got to put on a show, I guess, to make it fly. And that's part of the deal, I suppose.
Yeah, but you know, as often they are people I have met earlier on book tour or friends of friends. But the caller makes a good point.
Well, where next? You going to do this for another 10 years? Can you keep it up out there on the hoof?
As long as it's fun, as long as it's interesting to me, as long as my crew are engaged and telling me that we can make it stranger and weirder and more fun and different next year, then I'd be a fool to walk away.
Julie and Julia, the movie. What'd you make of it?
I thought it was half a good movie. I cared about Julia Child. I frankly didn't care about the other one so much.
Yeah, and is it true that you started out, smacking fish in Provincetown way back?
That's right. I started out as a dishwasher in Provincetown at the Flagship Restaurant in P-Town.
What's your next destination? What are we going to see next, maybe?
Going to Madrid. You'll be seeing me next. I think there's a Grenadines show, Beirut, Liberia, and a few others, but I'm going to actually shoot in Madrid.
How about Afghanistan?
We're hoping to do that next year. We're looking at it hard.
Take some soldiers to lunch. Or maybe they'll be home, better still.
Let's hope.
Anthony Bourdain, his new book is Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. Anthony Bourdain, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Been great having you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.